In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
In the majority of cases that involve any sort of abduction or violent conclusion, you have to look at you look first at the victim, you look at their background, their friends, their associates, their lifestyle. Now, the bear in mind we're talking about a very, very young child here. That narrows down almost immediately to the immediate family and then the friends, associates of the immediate family that were there at the time.
Graham Whetton used to be a police officer with London's Metropolitan Police. He joined the Met in 1977 and retired after 33 years of service in 2010. In that conversation with me, Graham was talking about the starting point for any missing persons case. They call it clearing the ground beneath your feet, looking at those nearest and closest to the person who is missing. From quite early on, Portuguese detectives harboured suspicions it was possible that someone might have faked Madeline McCann's abduction. They felt the crime scene inside the family's holiday apartment could have been staged, and they had doubts over some of what police were told had happened on the night Maddie vanished. In this episode, we're going to look at why. What was it about some parts of the crime scene and witness accounts that triggered those doubts?
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeline McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case.
In the hours after Kate McCann reported Maddie was missing from her bedroom, there were two pieces of evidence in particular which strongly suggested and drove the theory that Maddie had been abducted. The open window and shutters in Maddie's bedroom, and the crucial Jane Tanner sighting. You'll remember how in episode 1, Kate McCann said the bedroom window and metallic shutters were both wide open when she entered 5A to find Maddie gone from her bed. Kate even said a breeze had blown the bedroom door shut in her face and the curtain was fluttering in the wind. And you'll also remember Jane Tanner, one of the McCanns' friends in episode 1. At 9:10pm on the night Maddie vanished, Jane said she'd seen a man carrying a small child away from the direction of Maddie's bedroom. That sighting became known as the Tanner sighting. A 48-year-old Portuguese detective named Gonzalo Amaral was assigned to lead the inquiry into Maddie's disappearance. He was a high-ranking, streetwise chief inspector with the Portimão CID. Paulo Reis is a Portuguese journalist who covered the Maddie story. During a conversation I had with Paulo, he told me how the McCann case had ultimately ended Amaral's long police career and ruined his marriage. In the years after Maddie vanished, Amaral, of course, would become the target of a long and ugly legal battle with the McCanns over an explosive book he wrote about the investigation. His book was titled Maddie, The Truth of the Lie. To this day, Kate and Jerry McCann have always accused Amaral of being crippled by obsessive tunnel vision.
Gonçalo Amaral was one of the top investigations, one of the top CID inspectors. He was in charge, he was the second ranking CID inspector in Algarve. a man with more than 25 years of experience in the Portuguese criminal police. Algarve, as you know, is an area which has a very specific criminality, which is drug trafficking. So he had to deal with people that is very dangerous. He was, and he is, a very prestigious investigator.
Gonzalo Amaral and his team of detectives huddled together during a meeting that went late into the night on May 4, 24 hours after Maddie was reported missing. The group was vigorously debating three possibilities. One, she was abducted, as Kate and Jerry were insisting. Two, Maddie had woken up and walked out of the apartment. And three, something else had happened to Madeline, and that she was dead. Amaral and his team talked about a possible suspect, someone who must have closely watched the family habits for 6 days, monitoring their daily and nightly routine, looking for an opportunity. After all, the crime took place at a hotel, and it was entirely possible that someone with evil intent had a copy of the key to apartment 5A. But the team of detectives also struggled. It is hard to understand, Amaral would later write, how a potential abductor would have had the audacity to enter an apartment and abduct the child, knowing that the parents could burst in at any moment.
The thing about being a police officer and an investigator, and one of the first things you ever learn, is to keep an open mind about everything. So you have to look at all the facts and have an open mind and open approach when you look at any investigation. You have to gather all the facts, all the evidence and information, and then make an informed decision.
That's retired London Met police officer Graham Whetton again. While looking at parts of the case with Graham, I asked him if he had a theory about what happened to Maddie, if she was abducted from her bedroom, or if maybe something else had gone down on the night of May 3, 2007.
No, I don't. In all honesty, no, because I teach prospective police recruits, this one question can divide an entire room. The one question. One, do you think they were involved? And two, what do you think happened to her? And you can literally divide close friends, family, etc., with different opinions. My theory, come back down to, she went missing. Who was responsible and how that happened? I don't know enough about the events on the night to make an informed decision.
The early narrative of what happened to Maddie seemed to be all about an intruder breaking in through a window. Kate said when she discovered Maddie gone, that Maddie's bedroom door had blown closed in her face. When she opened the door, she said the window was open and the curtain was blowing. She also said the bedroom shutters were up.
The panic hit and I just ran back into her bedroom, and literally at that point, the curtains, which were closed, just kind of flew open. And that was when I noticed that the window was open as far as it could go, and the shutters outside had been raised all the way up. And I just knew straight away that someone had taken her.
That night, after reporting Maddie gone, Kate and Jerry called a group of people back in the United Kingdom. Those people included Jerry's sister, Trish Cameron, Kate's father, Brian Healy, and a couple of close friends. Now, we won't ever know what was said, but you can assume Kate and Jerry were telling people the terrible news and were looking for love and support from their innermost circle. The next morning, British media began interviewing family and friends of the McCanns. And here's something worth noting. Many of those close friends and family, the ones who had been called in the hours after Maddie vanished, well, they seemed to be speaking about jimmied and broken shutters. Kate's father, Brian Healy, was one. Here's what Brian told UK newspaper The Guardian on May 5. Jerry told me when they went back, the shutters to the room were broken. They were jimmied up and she was gone. Jerry's sister, Trish Cameron, was another. Here's what Trish told British tabloid The Mirror on May 4. When Kate checked, she came out screaming. Maddie had gone. The door was open and the window in the bedroom and shutters were jimmied open. They think someone must have come in the window and gone out the door with her. Jill Rennick, a family friend of the McCanns, did the same. Kate phoned Jill, who lived in Glasgow, on the morning of May 4. Jill then immediately called GMTV, the flagship breakfast show on UK channel ITV. Here's audio of Jill's phone call, which was patched into the studio.
They were just, you know, watching the hotel room and going back every half hour, and the shutters have been broken open and they've gone into the room and taken Madeline.
Is this a little girl, the sort of little girl that could have wandered off on her own? Would that be at all an option to look at?
Or do no, you not at all. It's been broken into.
Broken into. Jemmied open. Jemmied up. Shutters broken. The logical suggestion to anyone hearing that interview or reading those reports would be that an intruder broke into the McCann apartment through the window, picked Maddie up and carried her away. Carried her away in the manner that Jane Tanner claimed to have witnessed. But this supposedly clear-cut and dry scenario didn't seem to fit with what Gonzalo Amaral said he found at apartment 5A. In fact, Amaral claimed the shutters and window showed no signs of being tampered with. "It is obvious that no one has broken in and the lock has not been forced," wrote Amaral in his book, The Truth of the Lie. "No prints are lifted that are likely to belong to an unknown person, nor the slightest trace of gloves which could have been worn by a hypothetical abductor." The Portuguese forensic team did lift 5 good prints from the window. Someone's middle finger from their left hand left 3 prints on the glass, and that same person's forefinger, again from their left hand, left 2 prints on the window pane. The forensic team ran the prints and identified a person. It was Kate McCann. Now, it wouldn't be unusual for someone who was staying in that holiday apartment to have left prints on the window. And it wouldn't have been unusual for Kate to grab that window if she believed her daughter had been taken out through it. But what was undeniably odd was this. Despite those press reports in Britain claiming otherwise, the crucial bedroom window and shutters showed no sign of being broken open or jemmied up. In his book, Gonzalo Amaral called Kate McCann's description of the open window, curtains blowing, and shutters pulled up highly improbable. It was not possible to unlock the shutters from the street, he claimed. To get in through the window, Amaral said, you'd have had to break the shutters. So if there appeared to be no forensic evidence of someone coming in through the window, did a predator enter apartment 5A through one of its 2 doors? Perhaps the unlocked sliding door at the back patio of 5A. Once inside, did that person lift Maddie from her bed and carry her out through the window? Retired British policeman Peter McLeod has been to Prior de Luge and examined Maddie's bedroom window. Peter worked 28 years with the Nottingham Police and has written a book titled What Really Happened to Madeline McCann. He now lives in a small town in the Spanish region of Andalusia, and I've spoken to him a number of times. I've had problems recording our interviews. There was this annoying buzzing sound on the phone that I just couldn't get rid of. Peter was so keen to fix this that he went and borrowed a landline from a local shopkeeper, and at one point he drove to a larger nearby town to buy a hard-to-find phone fitting to sort the problem out. What did that tell me about Peter? He is a meticulous and determined man. Here's Peter talking about the dimensions of that window.
Your window is only an absolute maximum 50 centimetres wide, in reality about 46 wide, and it's already a metre off the ground. Now, I had a look at that, and my shoulders are wider than that little window, so although you could climb in sideways, you certainly can't jump in if you are a normal-sized person.
Peter, assuming that someone was going to carry a small child through that window, can you talk to me the logistics of how that would appear to be, possible?
I frankly do not think it's possible. It would be difficult enough to get yourself in. You'd have to grab hold of windows and grab hold of things. But, of course, the shutters are the problem, because the shutters are going to be bashing down on your head.
Right.
Either that or you've got to put a piece of wood in or something. And there's no suggestion of any of that. And then you've got to pick up a child without waking it up, without waking the other 2 children. I do not think it can be done, or let me put it another way, I do not see how anyone could do it.
The press reporting of Jemmy's shutters within hours of Maddie going missing was curious, to say the least. Peter remembers watching crime scene footage on Spanish news broadcasts.
Now, by mid-morning, on Spanish television, we could see the film from the scene of that girl, a hapless girl, in the white forensic suit, trying to lift a fingerprint off the shutters. And it's very obvious that the shutters were not damaged or smashed or forced or jammed. And it was at that point I thought, well, this is very, very strange. You've got the English press and the media still saying that they're smashed and broken and jammed. And yet we see that that is simply not the case. And that was the first red flag to me.
It was at this point that Peter made a bit of a leap with a theory as to how and why friends and family of the McCanns were talking to British journalists about Maddie's disappearance.
They have all been contacted individually at 1 or 2 in the morning by the McCanns. And one also suspects that they were told or asked to contact the press, because if someone rings you at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, you know, something's happened, your first thought is not to go rushing off to the BBC and Sky and everybody else. So one suspects that they were asked or told to go and tell the press all about it.
It's possible Peter is right. The Jemmy's shutter theme was being told to media by friends and family of the McCanns, and it did seem a consistent theme. But it's equally possible those people, when asked by journalists, just did their best to recount the nature of their phone calls with Kate and Jerry. Imagine it. Your child went missing a few hours ago. You're on holiday in a foreign country, and you frantically call home for support to tell friends about the tragedy. Details get blurred, information gets distorted. The second thing that appeared to trouble Portuguese police was potentially crucial inconsistencies in two early statements Jerry McCann gave to police. Those changes relate to the route Jerry said he walked to apartment 5A and which door he used to enter when he went to check on Maddie on the night she disappeared. On the late morning of May 4th, Kate and Jerry were driven by police officers to the police station in the neighbouring town of Portimão. It was about a 25-minute drive from Praia da Luz. Both Kate and Jerry were to give their first police statements, as were the members of the Tapas 7. You'll remember from episode 1 the term Tapas 7 was the name given to the seven friends, many who were doctors, who were on a group holiday with the McCanns. During Jerry's interview, he was asked about the family's holiday and what happened on the day and night of May 3. The interview eventually zeroed in on the point of the night when Jerry conducted his check on Maddie and the twins. Remember, at this stage of the evening, Jerry and Kate are now with their friends eating dinner at the tapas bar. The kids are said to be in apartment 5A, alone, asleep. Here's what Jerry says in that police interview. Jerry said at 9:05 p.m, he left the tapas bar and walked the long way around to the front door of 5A. That's important. Remember that detail. Jerry's walk to the front door takes about 2 minutes, which is about double the time it would have taken him to walk from the tapas bar to the much closer, backsliding door of 5A. Jerry tells police the front door was locked, so he uses his apartment key and enters. He says he checks on the kids, and they are all in the room sleeping. Maddie is there, safe and sound asleep. On Swedish TV show Skavlan in 2012, Jerry describes what he saw.
I went into a room and the door was open, and I just paused for a second and I looked and she was sound asleep. And I thought how beautiful she was. The twins were asleep in their cots, and I thought how lucky we were.
Jerry then goes to the bathroom and he leaves. It needs to be noted that during his interview, Jerry specifically tells police that when Kate checked the kids at 10 p.m, which is when she discovered Maddie was gone, that he believed Kate also entered through the locked front door using a key. After Jerry's interview finished, it was Kate's turn. She contradicted Jerry's account by saying she entered 5A through the unlocked backsliding door. So to recap, At 9:05 p.m, Jerry checks on the kids. He takes the long way to the front door of 5A, which is locked. He uses a key to enter. He says Kate followed exactly the same route as him. 6 days later, back in Portimao Police Station on May 10, during a longer, more intensive questioning session, Jerry gives a different account. He now tells detectives that he entered 5A through the back sliding door, which was unlocked. He now also tells police that the front door was likely unlocked, not locked, as he first stated. Now, even if Jerry forgot or was confused, does the change in his story matter? A number of police officers have told me that they expect small changes in statements that people give. The human memory is fallible. We're not computers, and recall of details is not an exact science.
I was with the U.S. Marshal Service for 24 years, retired as a supervisory deputy, United States Marshal in 2009. But during my career, I spent 9 years teaching interviewing techniques at the Marshal Service Training Academy. So for the past 25 years, that's what I've been doing, is just studying deceptive language. And I just teach people what to listen for, what to look for in a statement to see if that person is being truthful, if they're being deceptive, if they're lying, or if they're just withholding information.
Retired U.S. Marshal Mark McLeish has done cold case analysis for various U.S. media outlets. Mark has looked at the alleged ransom note of murdered American girl JonBenet Ramsey, and he's also analyzed long interviews that O.J. Simpson has conducted with various TV networks. He's also written a book titled I Know You Are Lying. Based in South Carolina, Mark projects that warm, convivial Southern feel when you speak to him. He's super switched on, a real clear communicator. It's easy to imagine him teaching these techniques to law enforcement officers. Mark has looked at a couple of key statements of the Maddie inquiry for me, and we'll look at his work and analysis in a future episode. But for now, Mark talked to me about people giving police statements and what it could potentially indicate if a witness suddenly changed a detail in their story. I asked Mark if Jerry's shift from the locked front door of 5A to the rear unlocked sliding door could have drawn the attention of police.
Yes, definitely would have thrown up a red flag. And that's why you do second interviews or even third interviews. I mean, what I like to do is have them write a written statement if the opportunity presents it. And then once they give me that written statement about what happened, then I do the interview, all right, tell me what happened. Because I'm looking to see if the story stays the same, and that's what you do with a second or third interview. If it's coming from memory, it should all be consistent. Now, they may provide additional information in the second interview. Everybody, even truthful people, edit their statement. They're not going to tell us 100% everything. So they may include some additional information, which is usually fine, but we're looking to see, is there any contradictions? As you mentioned, they mentioned a different door this time. So that creates a problem, because if it's coming from memory, everything should be in sequential order, and it shouldn't change, you know, from one statement to the next statement.
Look, there are always going to be small inconsistencies in statements. I think what's important is to look at the why. Why the change? Is there any benefit or payoff for someone changing a detail? If we consider Jerry's changing accounts, I see two potential reasons for that change. One, it brought his version of events in line with Kate and also Matt Oldfield, who both told police they entered 5A through the unlocked backsliding door on the night of May 3. And two, maybe Jerry just forgot and got it wrong in his first statement. He gave that first statement maybe 14 hours after Maddie was reported missing. Put yourself in his shoes. Your mind would be frazzled, wouldn't it? Or alternatively, would you not be razor sharp regarding a key movement that you made on the night your daughter goes missing? In that first statement, Jerry was very clear about a locked front door. He explicitly said he needed his key to enter 5A. And here's another thing to consider. Why walk the long route if you can take an easy shortcut? You're at dinner. Surely you want to get there and back as soon as possible. While inside, Jerry went to the bathroom. So why take a route twice as long if your bladder is full? The open bedroom window in 5A and Jerry's changing account both appeared to raise questions about what the McCanns said happened on the night of May 3. So I want to introduce a man called Jim Gamble. Jim was involved in the official investigation of Maddie's disappearance. As you'll hear, Jim harboured some doubt about the McCanns. But those initial feelings, they diminished over time.
At the time Madeleine McCann went missing, I was the chief executive of the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre, a UK law enforcement agency that fundamentally focused on safeguarding children and young people.
In the immediate aftermath of Maddie going missing, the UK Foreign Office contacted Jim Gamble, who was head of CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre. The Foreign Office requested CEOP go and help the Portuguese police. Jim explained how CEOP sent profilers to Praia da Luz. They spoke to the McCanns and got a feel for the case. Their objective was to try and work out who or what type of person was the offender if Maddie got abducted. We'll be hearing more from Jim in later episodes, but for now, I asked him if he thought the McCanns could have been involved in the disappearance of Madeleine.
When the case first began to unravel and I began to simply watch the news feed and then get direct feedback from our team on the ground, being a police officer, I'm a cynic and I believe that any good investigator clears the ground beneath their feet. So, of course, the first people you suspect are the parents. And because, you know, they are there, they're in proximity, it is their child. So did I believe at the beginning that the parents could possibly have done it? Yes, of course. And as time went on, did I see evidence that supported that hypothesis? No, I didn't. And in fact, as more evidence became, available, my initial suspicion became more and more diluted. Now, that's not to say that something couldn't turn up in the future where I think, oh, flip, I was right in the beginning and I'm wrong now, but I've seen nothing, been briefed on nothing and heard nothing that would make me think that Jerry and Kate McCann are guilty of something to do with their daughter's disappearance.
If an abduction happened, it took place between 9:05 p.m. and 10 p.m. Why? Jerry told police he checked at 9:05 p.m. and saw Maddie sleeping. At 10 p.m., when Kate checks, she tells police Maddie is gone. Although Matt Oldfield makes a check at 9:30 p.m., he's unable to tell police if Maddie was there or not. He goes into 5A, but he stops at the bedroom door. He sees the twins, but he doesn't poke his head around the corner to look for Maddie. The witness statement of Jane Tanner, who was one of the Tapas 7, potentially indicated when the abduction took place. At 9:10 p.m., just 5 minutes after Jerry had left to check on the kids, Jane Tanner rose from the table at the tapas bar. She was going to check on her two daughters, who she said had been left alone in a ground floor apartment, a couple of units to the left of the McCanns. I'm going to let Pat Brown, a US criminal profiler from Washington, D.C., pick up the Jane Tanner story here. Pat has studied the Maddie McCann case in exhaustive detail since really early on. She's visited Praia da Luz and also written a book outlining her theory about what happened to Maddie. In my chat with Pat, you'll hear her reference Jerry speaking with a man named Jez. To recap from episode 1, Jez is Jeremy Wilkins, a man Jerry stopped to chat with after leaving 5A following his check on the kids at 9:05 p.m. The timing is important.
Originally, Jane Tanner claimed that she was going back up to her flat and she was walking up the, when you come out of the tapas restaurant and you come out to the gate there, you turn left and you go up this little street and then the apartments are there. It's not a very long walk, but you do have to walk up it. And she claimed she walked up this street and she saw Jerry talking to Jez and she walked by them, didn't say hello to them, just walked by them. And as she had saw them standing there, she also saw the man that she claimed she saw carrying a child from the vicinity of the McCann flat. That's what she claims. And neither one of them saw her. And they also didn't see the man that she said was carrying a child away from the flat. Now, I looked at them and I said, okay, before I got the Pride of Luge, I thought, well, maybe it's just a busy street, lots of people on it, it's quite large, she's there on one side, she's on the other. Not at all. At that time of night, the street is dead. I mean, it's just, there's hardly anybody on it. It's just very, very quiet. And it's also very contained street. There's not, like, trees all over it and you know, weird spots where you could, you know, sort of get lost in. It's just a street with, basically, it's very, very narrow. And if anybody's walking up that street, you know it. And she's walking along with, you know, flip-flops or sandals, whatever she had on, up the street. You can even hear that. So how she would pass these two men and they wouldn't notice her, it's kind of hard to believe. Now, one could say they were involved in an intense conversation, just somehow she got by them. Okay. But they didn't see the man carrying the child either, which I thought was very peculiar. So no matter what, I stood in the different directions they would stand in. And basically to me, you either had to see Jane or you had to see the guy with the child, or you had to see both of them, but I just couldn't see how you could see, neither man could see, neither see either of them. It made no sense.
To get a really good visual understanding of what Pat is talking about, go to 9.com.au/Maddie. We've got photos and videos of that street where Jane Tanner walked, and graphics showing the changing routes Jerry travelled on the night of May 3. Chief Inspector Gonzalo Amaral and other Portuguese detectives also had concerns over the reliability of Jane Tanner's information. In his book, Amaral wrote about a meeting detectives had on the night of May 9th, 6 days after Maddie vanished. They discussed the Jane Tanner sighting. He wrote, "We had reviewed Jane Tanner's witness statement in detail. The individual whom she saw parading around in the open street with the child he had just abducted seems less and less credible to us." An official police report dated 10th September 2007 also questioned how Jane Tanner had passed Jerry and Jez without being seen. Chief Inspector Tavares G. Almeida wrote, "How to pass at scarcely 2 or 3 meters from each other without seeing one another? I've contacted Jez Wilkins several times to see if he would talk about that night. He has never responded." In an extremely rare media appearance by Jane Tanner, her version of events was aired in 2009 by British broadcaster Channel 4. The show was called Madeline Was Here, and it set out to reconstruct events of May 3. In one remarkable scene that ends with Jane Tanner in tears, she and Jerry clash over where Jane was trying to tell the film crew and private detectives who had been hired by the McCanns where she had seen Jerry and Jez Wilkins speaking.
"So I think you were about here, and I think you were standing like that, and Joe and Jez was there with his pram pointing down that way. Because I think if you'd have been looking at me, because I would have said something, because I would have said about, because Kate had been moaning that you'd been gone a long time watching the football."
"I'm almost certain that when I came out, I came over and he was here, and I was like that. That's my memory of it, is like Jez is 6'3 or something and looking up and then turning in when I finish." Mm. "That's my memory of
yeah,
it."
"Yeah, I mean, well, they just..."
"I mean, it's like I said, there are inconsistencies, you know, in every major investigation."
"Okay, that's fine."
"Obviously, the most important thing is what you saw, Jane. It's not where Jerry and Jez were actually stood, because they didn't obstruct your view of the man you saw."
But does it matter where they stood? I think it does matter. It is worth noting that in that reconstruction, Jane remembers Jerry and Jez being in a position on the side of the road closest to apartment 5A. From that position, it looks really difficult for Jerry or Jez to not see Jane as she makes her check on May 3. But Jerry's memory and point of view is different to Jane's. He claims he and Jez were standing at a spot on the opposite side of the road, a distance of about 3 to 4 meters away from where Jane indicated. The position where Jerry insists he was standing, it is possible, but still seems unlikely, that he and Jez would not see her. Who is right? We don't know, but at the end of it all, Jane Tanner ends up crying.
"Okay. I tell you what, if you stand here..."
"Do you want to go?"
So why is Jane Tanner and this alleged meeting with Jerry and Jez so important in all of this? Well, a couple of reasons. Her reported sighting reinforces the theory that an abduction took place, that Madeline was stolen by someone. And Jane's witness statement also puts Jerry on the street at a time when his daughter is supposedly being taken away by a man carrying her in the darkness.
So yeah, I just got up and walked out of the tapas bar past Jerry talking to Jez. That's when I saw somebody walk across the top of the road carrying a child. And I think I did think, oh, well, there's obviously somebody taking their child home to bed. But they didn't look like a standard tourist.
Here's another thing about the Jane Tanner sighting. Jerry leaves the table at the tapas bar to go and check on the kids at 9:05 p.m. It takes about 1 minute to walk to 5A. He sees the kids all sleeping, safely in bed. He uses the bathroom. As a surgeon, let's assume he's the kind of man to wash his hands. That takes us to about 9:08 p.m. He walks out of 5A, spots Jez Wilkins on the street, and begins to chat. At about 9:10 p.m, Jane Tanner leaves the tapas bar to go and check her children. She walks up the quiet road past Jerry and Jez. Neither of them sees her. But Jane now sees a man carrying a child across the road up ahead. It must now be about 9:11 p.m. So what does that timeline mean? It means if Jane Tanner saw the abductor, the intruder had to have entered 5A after Jerry left at about 9:08 p.m, pick Maddie up, steal her out the front door or open bedroom window in about 2 minutes, just in time for him to be seen by Jane Tanner. It's possible, but it seems unlikely. Another scenario put forward is that an abductor could have been hiding inside 5A when Jerry checks on the kids at 9:05 p.m. It's possible an abductor, disturbed by Jerry's visit, hides in the master bedroom, or even behind Maddie's bedroom door, as Jerry puts his head in and claims to see all three children sleeping. Whenever I speak with criminal profiler Pat Brown about her theories on Maddie, or when we begin to explore what certain evidence or actions might indicate, she'll always word things in a very precise and particular way. She'll always say something like, "The totality of the evidence leads me to believe the number one theory should be, insert theory here." I can understand that. Pat's book, Profile of the Disappearance of Madeline McCann, which outlined her research into the case, it was stocked by Amazon. Well, it was until the McCann's lawyers threatened Amazon and it was removed. Pat raises a different issue about the information reported by Jane Tanner.
If this was the only child being carried away, then this would seem to be the kidnapper and Jerry had an alibi. But the problem with the Smith sighting is that now there's two men in town carrying away little girls.
Back up. I can hear you thinking, the Smith sighting? A second sighting of a different man carrying a child in a completely different location. Who or what is the Smith sighting? Irishman Martin Smith and his family were on holiday in Praia da Luz the night Maddie vanished. On May 3 at 10 p.m, while they were walking back to their accommodation, they saw a man carrying a small girl in his arms down a dark street that led towards the beach and sea. The location for the sighting was about 270 metres south of apartment 5A and the Ocean Club Resort as the crow flies. They crossed paths on a quiet street. The beach was close, just another 150 metres or so from rocks and the ocean. Martin Smith and two members of his family would give statements to police on the 26th of May, but it wasn't really until the 20th of September that the Smith family sighting was suddenly thrust into the spotlight. It was now 4 months into the police investigation, and the McCanns had sensationally just been declared arguidos, the Portuguese word for formal suspects. We look at why that was in a later episode. Within days of this sudden development, Kate and Jerry and their two-year-old twins, Sean and Emily, flew out of Portugal on an EasyJet flight and returned to England, landing in East Midlands Airport. News cameras and journalists were waiting to capture the family disembarking the plane, down a set of stairs and onto the runway. Here's Jerry giving a briefing to those reporters. Jerry's wearing a pale blue polo shirt, and he's holding Sean. Sean's blonde head is nestled into his dad's neck. Kate is standing to the left of Jerry, holding Emily.
Today, Kate, Sean, Emily and I have returned home as we planned a while ago. We're returning to Britain after very careful thought. We want the twins, as much as is reasonably possible, to live an ordinary life in their home country, and want to consider the events of the last few days, which have been so deeply disturbing. Whilst it's heartbreaking to return to the UK without Madeline, it does not mean we're giving up our search for her. As parents, we cannot give up on our daughter until we know what has happened. We have to keep doing everything that we can to find her. Kate and I wish to thank once again all those who have supported us over the past days, weeks and months. But we would also like to ask for our privacy to be respected now that we have returned home. Our return is with the full agreement of the Portuguese authorities and police. Portuguese law prohibits us from commenting further on the police investigation. Despite there being so much, we wish to say we are unable to do so, except to say this. We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
Now back in Drogheda, Ireland, Martin Smith is watching the 10 o'clock news. Jerry and the McCann family are there, in front of the cameras, on the tarmac. Martin Smith sees something. Over the following days, it nags away at him. Then, on September 20, Martin Smith reached for the phone and he called Leicestershire Police, the local constabulary where the McCanns lived. The Leicestershire police officer who took the call from Martin Smith typed out a message and sent an alert to the teams investigating Maddie's disappearance. That alert describes Martin Smith as sounding shaken and worried. In an official note, the police officer wrote, Martin Smith was watching the 10 p.m. news on BBC and saw the McCanns getting off the plane and coming down the steps. He said it was like watching an action replay of the night he saw the male carrying the child back in Portugal. Martin Smith told the police officer the way Jerry had carried his son Sean triggered a memory. It looked exactly like the man he saw on the night Maddie went missing. In the next episode of Maddie,
there is a degree of variation between what individuals say and also what the whole group says.
The Smith sighting seems to blow up the credibility of the Tanner sighting. The Smith family produces two EFITs, but incredibly, they're not shown to the public until 2013, more than 5 years after they were drawn. Is the Smith sighting wrong place, wrong time, or is it the key to the Maddie mystery? The Maddie podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.